I can get is static or variations on the central musical rhythm.
I only wish there was some way we could tell it to shut up. It's driving me crazy. And it keeps getting louder.
We have no way of estimating the volume this creature can produce.
The only logical solution is to listen to CJS at 90.1 FM. They broadcast from Burnaby Mountain in British Columbia. Let's tune in now.
Philosophy Show. I'm Michael Robert Kaditz. I'm here today with Aaron Wang and Brandon Brownlee. Same two guys that I was with last week when we started talking about biological evolution, natural selection, cultural evolution, how they might be related. We never really got to cultural evolution because we spent a lot of time on concepts related to natural selection, and I introduced some of my own concepts, some of my own take on the matters. Where I want to go eventually is to talk a bit about cultural evolution and how they might be linked. That is to say, cultural evolution and biological evolution. Maybe go over a couple of the prevailing theories and also introduce some of my own views on it, on the relationship between those two. But just before the show, Aaron, you were saying that you wanted to go over where we left off last time, which was this kind of interesting take that I introduced, where I brought in some medieval theory. We probably didn't get clear about why that's relevant to contemporary discussion on evolution. But I want to talk about that a little bit. So I talked about what Edward Fraser talks about in a couple of his books when he is teaching about the scholastic St. Thomas Aquinas. And this actually relates to several proofs, or at least one proof, one of the five proofs that Thomas Aquinas gave, one of the five ways for the existence of God. So what does this have to do with evolution? Almost seems like antithetical, right? But actually, I think it's relevant from my point of view. So Aquinas talked about how there are two different types of causal chains. One type is the type where the original cause must persist in order to keep the chain in motion. So the example that I gave was there's a hand which is moving a stick. The stick moves the rock. The rock lands on top of a leaf and moves the leaf. Well, the hand has to keep moving that stick to keep this entire sequence of events in motion. So that's a type of causal chain where the first cause is necessary for the second causes, right? All the additional things to happen. And that is known as a per se causal chain in scholastic thinking. Per se causal chain. And you can see where that was, why that was used in scholastic thinking as a proof for God, because that was the model that was given for the way the universe works. That if God ceased to be the designer and director and stopped moving his hand, right, then the universe would stop, would end, life would end, all the features of the universe would be gone because God is persisting in his, in his movement, in his creation. So that was sort of given as a proof for God that the universe wouldn't be here and wouldn't continue to be here. We wouldn't be talking. We wouldn't be alive. Nothing would be happening if God didn't continue with intention his, you know, perpetuation of the universe. So that was given as a proof for God. So I'm not here to argue for God. I'm here to, right now, to talk about this type of causal chain. And that's contrasted with a different type of causal chain, which might be exemplified this way. So a grandson's existence is not dependent on the grandfather's continued action or existence. So once a child is born, I mean, barring, you know, requirements for sustenance and food and all that, if parents and grandparents die, cease to exist, the child doesn't just die, right? The child lives. So the initial cause of the child can cease to function, but the causal chain persists. That is known as a, in scholastic thinking, as a per accidens, A-C-C-I-D-E-N-S, causal chain.
It might be interesting to talk about how scientific theories and scientific laws, for some people, and I don't know if this is correct or if it's incorrect, so maybe it's worth talking about. If scientific laws operate as per se causes, like if we think about something like the law of gravity, if that's, you know, an immutable characteristic of the universe, then it's, you know, it's something that's acting all the time. So do we consider something like that a per se cause? And if the theory of genetic evolution that we're talking about, is that also that... I mean, I think you were arguing in the last show that it's not a per se cause because it speaks of things that are not related.
So that's an interesting question. Is a law of the of physics, like say the law of motion or of gravity, is that a cause? I'm not sure that natural laws are causes. I think from my point of view, they might govern what happens when there's a stimulus or there's a initial cause that might govern what transpires, like what the effects will be. But is the law an actual cause? I'm skeptical of that. However, your point is well taken that the law must continue to be the law for there to be a predictable causal chain. We could get into David Hume, what he said about justifiability of assuming that the laws of nature will remain the same, but that probably is a divergence from our topic.
I think the thing that I would notice with this is that if a law is functional in the universe as a per se cause, that would imply... Or it would seem to permit the possibility that, like, if the law vanishes, then the universe just won't operate on those principles. But that's not the idea we have of a law. Laws don't just, for whatever reason, you can't cause a law to no longer apply unless you find some, you know, circumstance where a law doesn't apply. I'm trying to think of. But then that would be explained by some other scientific law that, you know, so these laws, maybe I'm being a bit nominalist, but I'm saying that what we think of as laws aren't really causes. They just describe the relations between causes and effects.
Yeah, if I pick up a brick and throw it toward a window, the trajectory, the force with which the brick hits the window, what happens to the window, where the brick ends up, all those things are governed by the laws of physics. We may not know what all the parameters are. We may not know where the brick's going to land, but nonetheless, the laws of physics would dictate exactly what's going to happen to the brick, the window, and all that. But the laws of physics aren't the cause of the brick being thrown toward the window. They, you know, they might govern what happens.
So it seems then that it's a fallacy, at least according to our reasoning, that to attribute a scientific law as a cause would then be a fallacy, because that's not its nature.
Yeah, it makes me think of Aristotle's energeia, where force is the thing that causes a thing to move, or it explains the persistence of the movement of an object, whereas the law of inertia says actually force just changes something's movement. So ascribing a law as a cause is kind of like ascribing energeia to the movement of an object. It's not like the energy that is, or it's not like the movement of an object is explained by some energeia in it that is imminent in its movement. It's just that force changes its movement, and the law of inertia describes that something will just keep moving until it stops or is changed.
Well, what's interesting is the distinction between the law and the thing. So when we talk about gravity, there's a distinction between the law of gravity and the actual force of gravity. So the law describes the force. I want to give some recognition there to what you said, Aaron, because it's true with what you said with respect to the actual force of gravity. So if I drop an object, there's a per se causal chain happening, in the sense that if suddenly, and it's possible, right? It's possible. It's not logically impossible. And Hume would point this out, that the law of gravity, which describes the force of gravity, let's say the force of gravity could change or could disappear during the time that this object is falling. If it did, the object would cease to fall, or would fall differently, or do something different. So that is a per se causal chain in a sense. I think maybe this is what you're getting at, Aaron, because the force of gravity must remain as it is for the chain to continue. So if the force of gravity continues, then the object will fall at the rate of free fall. It will hit the ground, will cause certain sound, and certain amount of force with which it hits the ground might disrupt other objects on the ground, might create a hole in the ground. The brick might, if it's a brick, it might, you know, disintegrate or fall apart or crack. But none of those things would happen if the force of gravity were to suddenly vanish or to change. So that is, in a sense, a per se causal chain. So that's good. It's a good analysis, because it helps us understand, with more clarity, what a per se causal chain is. And what's really interesting is they become somewhat blurred, right? Because the example that I gave of a per accident causal chain, where the initial cause does not need to persist, maybe not with respect to that particular causal chain, if the grandson can exist even if the grandfather no longer exists. But there's other causal chains in play also, which is that the grandson's continued existence depends on the continued existence of oxygen and water and a certain temperature range with which humans can live. So what's interesting about this, actually, which I wasn't anticipating we would get into, is it's only for educational purposes that we talk about singular causal chains, because in reality, what we have is a web of causal chains. It's almost infinite, I think. We live in a web of causal chains, with first causes, second causes, some are per accidents and some are per se. And that might be relevant to the question of evolution. Well, let's see if it is. So how are these sort of arcane references to scholastic thinking relevant to a contemporary conversation on biological and cultural evolution? Well, my insight is that evolution by genetic natural selection is, in a sense, a per accidents causal chain. Because once the genetic makeup of humans, right, once the genes have evolved over time, they don't have to continue changing, or they don't have a newborn child, let's say it's a human, automatically, innately, is now born with all of the cumulative past changes that have happened to human genetics. It doesn't have to be a re-exposure or reintroduction of previous changes. They're cumulative. So the fact that I have, you know, the size hands that I have, the size fingers, the size head, the size brain, isn't dependent on anything in the past that ever happened. I mean, it already happened, right? Nothing new has to happen now for me to have the characteristics of a contemporary human being. So that's why I'm saying it's per accidents. The size of my head is not dependent on anything happening now. It already happened. It's done. It isn't still happening. The processes of natural selection, of genetic mutation that have happened in the past over many, many generations, right, over millennia, that have led to my physical characteristics as a human being, they don't have to keep happening. They're already done. So that's why I'm saying it's a per accident causal chain. Do you guys agree with that? Any objections to that analogy? I'll take silence as agreement.
I think it does. It does fit. It does fit the evolutionary model quite well to consider it per accidents causes, just because it's the nature of genetics that the original cause doesn't have a direct effect on subsequent causes. It's only the most direct parents who will have an immediate effect. So, although it does depend on the specific genetics you're talking about. So I do think it works, but we'll see where we take this, especially if we get to cultural evolution, because that might be true of individual genetic evolution, that the philosophical concept of pre-accident causes maps onto it well, but that might not be true for cultural evolution, because when we're dealing with groups of people.
The thing I'm noticing about this, so when I first learned about these per-accidents causes, the thing that struck me was, in distinction from per se causes, is the relationship between the cause and effect, right? So in a per se cause and effect relation, there's a kind of dependence on the two. One is dependent on the other. But in a per accidents cause, it seems like there's a certain independence. The cause can disappear, it can cease to exist, and you have this independent cause. But I think the thing that you're kind of emphasizing when you are talking about these per accidents causes is that there is a persistent object that survives the cause, and it has a certain durability. It kind of retains the nature of the cause in a certain way. And in that way, a cause has a certain durable existence. I think that's kind of what you're, because I don't, maybe it is, but this is what I'm noticing about you wanting to bring in per accidents causes to the discussion of biological and cultural evolution, is that you can explain the continued, you can explain a persistent existence of an effect with this distinction that, say, we evolved to have hands of a certain size, as you say, and that was conditioned by a particular environment or circumstances. That circumstance continues through its effect in that regard. Maybe I'm looking for something more than it is really there, but I'm noticing this about your analysis of causes and what you're doing with it.
I think you have it right. I think that's the point. You know, the point is that there's something about genetic mutations and then the process of natural selection, which is such that when new offspring appear or born or hatched or whatever they are, right? If it's humans, they're born. There's nothing more that has to be done. They inherit the characteristics, the current characteristics of a human being, along with some variation, variations in genetic mutations and variations. There's always going to be that.
which is actually the basis for natural selection, because there's always going to be variations. But essentially, there's no relearning or no re-exposure or nothing else that has to be done. It's innate now, right? So the aggregate of past genetic mutations and adaptations and selections, I now, as a human organism, have inherited without any choice in the matter and without any work that needs to be done or with any re-education or re-exposure or anything like that. So my claim is that, you know, it's fairly, you know, self-evident. I think that should be fairly uncontroversial, what I'm saying. But the reason I'm pointing it out is because I'm going to draw a distinction between that and what we find in other, you know, in say cultural evolution. That's where I'm going with this. Because what I want to do is to talk about cultural evolution and compare cultural evolution to biological and make some comments about whether we can make an analogy between cultural and biological. And so this is, I think, is going to be an important difference, and that's where I'm going. An important distinction. So maybe I'll just go there, right, without too much more preparation. So when it comes to cultural evolution, it's not brand new, but it's a cutting edge field, right? It hasn't been around as long as biological evolution. Even Darwin started to go there when he talked about morality and so on, which is arguably cultural, although some would argue that it's immoral. Realists would say that morality has nothing to do with culture. It's just, in, you know, it's a priori. But let's say that cultural evolution is sort of a cutting edge field, and there's still not uniformity. There's not as much uniformity and or as much agreement around what the cultural evolution is as there is now around Darwinian natural selection and genetic evolution and that kind of thing. So I've done some research on some of the contemporary theories around it. And one of the very popular, recognized theories now, it's not the only one, around cultural evolution, it's called the dual inheritance model. And that's been advocated by a guy named Joe Heinrich, a contemporary. And what that model says is that there are two tracks, there's two parallel tracks. So you have biological evolution on one track, and then separately, but related, you have a track of cultural evolution. And it's a dual inheritance because the argument is that humans inherit their biological and cultural characteristics from both of those tracks, and that there's an interplay between the two of them. Perhaps that's the most important point, is that there's an interplay. They inform each other, is the claim. And there's skeptics who doubt that, but there is considerable evidence for a interplay, right, for a exchange between biological and cultural. So there's some problems with cultural evolution. I'm not saying that it doesn't happen. I'm saying that there's some issues with it that we don't run into with biological evolution. And one of the issues is related to these causal chains. So this is how I'm going to make this relevant now. If biological evolution happens genetically in a per accidents fashion, how can we say that cultural evolution happens per accidents? How can cultural evolution progress or move in that same way? In the case of biological evolution, it's DNA and genes that carry the information. So genes are the information which is transmitted or propagated forward in a per accidents fashion. So biological evolution uses genes. So the reason that I am born with the characteristics of a current human being, of a current Homo sapien, of a contemporary Homo sapien, is because I have the genes, right? The genes within me carry in a per accidents fashion the aggregate changes of all, you know, prior human generations. That's why I don't have to do anything. It's in my genes, right? The size of my hands, size of my brain, all those things are genetically propagated. They're in my genes. But what is it that would be analogous in cultural evolution? How can we say that a human being born now somehow innately possesses culture and all the and the aggregate of cultural changes that have happened in the past? I think that's a challenge. That's one of the problems. Like, how can we explain that? If we're trying to analogize cultural evolution with biological evolution, if we want to say that cultural evolution is a thing, which is what dual inheritance model suggests, that cultural evolution is another track alongside biological evolution. It's related to biological evolution, but it's a thing. It's an entity. It's a phenomenon in its own right. How can we analogize it to biological evolution? What is the analog to a gene or to DNA of culture that would carry culture forward? How does culture get carried forward from one generation to the next? So I have some ideas about that, and there are claims about that, but I just want to stop there and get some reaction from you guys and see if you kind of see where I'm going here with now with this per accidents versus per se causal chain models. How do we explain cultural evolution if we don't have genes, DNA and genes, to propagate culture? Or maybe we do. What do you think?
I do think that there's kind of an easy counter argument, and I think it's probably a little reductionistic, but it would basically say that you can't say what we say about biological evolution about cultural evolution, that they're just, you know, it's comparing apples to oranges. They're just two very, very different things. I think there's a lot of social theorists that would say that, like, to talk about a culture, you have to start with a society, and culture is a property of society. And while we could have an analogy of, you know, in evolution, we have a species and we have individuals of that species, you don't see in biological evolution the same types of nuances that you see in societies. Now to break apart my own argument, I think that's potentially not very good, because on one side of things, on the other side of things, we can actually see quite a lot of similarities. We can see that a cultural evolutionary model has pieces of information, as the biological evolutionary model does, that those pieces of information have mechanisms for being retained or for being lost or removed. And we can see things rather than the fundamental issue being propagation. The fundamental issue, I think, for human beings is issues of immediate coordination or cooperation. So it's less about the propagation of the individuals of those species some long point in the future, and it's more about creating some short-term coordination and collaboration among individuals, or avoiding those things among certain individuals.
I don't know if I'm thinking along the same lines, but especially when we're talking about this distinction between per accidents and per se causes, it is really difficult to get out of this picture of seeing culture as a per se phenomenon. I mean, something like language is passed down, but it has to be passed down not through it's not passed down at the point of physical reproduction. It's passed down through being raised in a certain language. You learn a language when you are born into it. But what is naturally passed on, what is biologically passed on, might be some sort of psychological mechanism for learning a language. I'm thinking, and maybe things like social customs too, and even things like virtues, if Aristotle is right to say that we're born not with any of the virtues, but we're born with the capacity to acquire the virtues.